We're good to go.
Are you ready, Nathan? We're recording.
We're good to go.
Okay, here we go. This is a regular meeting of the San Juan County Public Hospital District Number 1 Board of Commissioners. It is Wednesday, July 22nd, 2020. It's 5:30. The meeting is being held remotely under COVID-19 emergency rules. The public can call in at 509-824-1884 and at 523-292-241#. Please be sure, if you're calling in and you're not a commissioner, to mute yourself. And if you do have a comment for public comment, and you need to reach out to Nathan Butler so he can unmute you. And that's butler@sanjuancountypublichospitaldistrict1.org if you wish to comment. So we're going to call this meeting to order. And roll call, please, Nathan.
Sure. Commissioner Clary?
Present.
Commissioner Lehman?
Here.
Commissioner Lindstrom?
Present.
Commissioner Lachine Seitz?
Present.
Commissioner Loring?
Here.
And then additionally, we have Chief Kutzing?
I'm here.
Superintendent Hutchins? She said she was here, but she's muted.
I'm present.
All right, there we go. Everyone's present, Chair Lindstrom.
Thank you. So the next item is our consent agenda. Are there any amendments to the current agenda from any commissioners? Okay. So could I hear a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I make a motion to approve the consent agenda. This is Commissioner Lehman.
I second.
Commissioner Clary.
I will say Commissioner Clary seconded. We'll vote by roll call. Commissioner Clary?
Aye.
Commissioner Lehman?
Aye.
I myself say aye. Commissioner Lachine Seitz?
Aye.
Commissioner Loring?
Yes.
For the record, the vote is 5-0. The motion passes. And now, if we've approved the consent agenda, we'll move on to audience participation. And that's a 15-minute limit on the time for it, and it's a maximum of 3 minutes each per person. Members of the public can press *6 to unmute themselves and announce their intention to speak so we can generate a list.
Looks like we only have two members of the public present, and I haven't received any emails from the public wanting to comment or read anything.
Okay. And we're not hearing from any public at this time.
Yeah, if you'd like to speak, unmute yourself, *6. Yeah, I don't hear anybody.
We're good. All right, so we'll move on to operations report with Superintendent Hutchins, please.
Okay, this report is for the month of June, which means we're halfway through 2020, our financials. As far as our cash...
Hello? Oh, yes? Is there someone there?
Yeah, hi. Can people hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Oh, good, good. Hi, I don't have anything to comment, but I wanted to introduce myself. I met Pamela the other evening. My name is Jack Estrada. I'm the interim CAO at Peace Island Medical Center, filling in for Mary Ann Keene, who just retired.
Well, Jack, thank you for calling in. It's nice to meet you.
You as well. Thank you.
Yeah, welcome to the IMC. Looking forward to working with you.
Yes. I as well. Thank you.
Welcome.
I'm sorry we had a little delayed reaction. reaction to you being present on the phone there. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. I was trying to figure it out myself. So I don't have any comment, but I wanted to at least introduce myself and let you know that I was on the call.
Thank you. And I did see the letter from your boss today saying that there will be two of you filling Marianne's shoes for a period of time.
That is correct. Teresa Loya is our director of nursing. We'll be filling in the nursing clinical end of things, and I will fill in the administrative part.
And are you planning to be present on the island, or is this a virtual?
I am.
Yeah, okay, well, welcome.
Yep, virtual meeting, but yes, I am planning on being on the island, maybe a day or two each week, but I, for the most part, will be here, yes.
Great. Okay. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
And if we have nothing else for Mr. Estrada, we can get back to Superintendent Hutchins.
Okay. I will start over. We're in the month of June. We are, for as far as cash and receipts for the month of June, we had $38,113.55 come in, and most of that, $1,539.75, was property tax revenue, and then $2,568.80 was leasehold taxes. And interestingly enough, the taxes in June were 107% higher than last June, which is kind of unusual. So I dug into that a little bit further, contacted the treasurer's office, and that is seemingly coming from the people have caught up on their payments that they arrangements that they had made with the auditor's office to spread their first half property taxes out. So the money came in later and caught up in June, so that made June's property taxes higher than normal. So with that, our yearly taxes are still up about 3% from last year. So at least we are holding our own for now, and we'll just keep a close eye on those receipts every month, and I'm going to keep in close contact with the treasurer's office to see if any problems arise there. But as of now, they don't have any report as to things changing right now. But we'll look at that every month. The for the month is $804,806. Says ready to make our Peace Health subsidy payment probably next month. So we have plenty of cash available for that and operations for the rest of the year. Expense, we had $45,659.95 for accounts payable in June, and this was almost 1% higher than last year this month. All in all, had two records requests for the month of June, simple records requests that were filled, no problems there. That brings our total records requests for the year to four, which have cost us about $500, so we're doing well on that front at this time. And then you all received your revenue and expenditures fund, and your EGM reports, your revenue detail, your cash balance, your expense status report. We did not get our outstanding warrants report yet this month. The county was running a little bit behind. But we, like I said, this is halfway through the year. We're at about 50%. So if you go down the revenue and funds, there's just a few things that are higher, are explained, and some things we make a payment on for the year, so when we do that, it puts the percentage a little bit out of the range, but no problems at this time. I'll be making our amended budget for 2020 next month. We got our beginning cash letter, are about $11,000 higher in our actual balance, so we'll be adding $11,000 to our amended budget and maybe adjusting a few items. Some items. On the financials, anything you want to talk about? Nope. Okay. The
sorry, Superintendent. There were no payroll warrants for June. Is that because those were delayed? That we were saying before.
Yes, and also a pay for. I turned in your pay for the second quarter, so that'll.
Your payroll, those payroll warrants are the.
So is that EMS? A month behind, it would be what May's reimbursements were to EMS, but they're essentially about even, both on salary. The only change is when someone requests some of their PTO to be cashed out, but other than that, salary is the same every month, but we reimburse EMS the month after, so that we're making sure we reimburse them for every penny that they're caught up on our expenses, so it's a zero net for.
Okay. So the staff salaries look at, they come through as payables and not payroll, and that's why I think I was confused on that.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're front page.
And that's.
Thank you.
We process your payroll through EMS as penalty, so it's something that we'd have to revise. Integration went forward and EMS under fire, then we'd have to sort out how we're processing your payroll, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. We'd have to take it back and put it on the monthly payroll with the commissioners. So I would start, instead of doing it quarterly, I would start having to do it monthly so that Nathan and I could be processed through the county that way. Yeah. Okay. Operationally, we have been granted the access to keep doing our virtual meetings like we've been doing through August 1st, but then we'll have another update on how we are to proceed. So we just keep a lookout on that every time that they extend the date. They're still, the EOC is doing a great job reporting on COVID. They still have their, if you go on to the San Juan County website at the very top, they have that COVID-19 banner, and you click on that and you can find out all kinds of information there. And that's good for catching up on anything you would like to find out about COVID and what our county is doing. We had our July 4th come and gone, and we did have fireworks, and we did have a lot more visitors, so we need to all be aware that there are more people in town and to make sure we're being vigilant in what our health expert is telling us to do, and to watch your own health and be vigilant for what you need to do, and recognize that there are a lot more people in town. So just want to make everybody aware of that. And I'm sure you do know, because when you go to town, you can't find a parking place now. let's see. We started our planning session last Saturday for our strategic planning. I think that went really well. It was really nice to have the that, led by Daphne Snyder, and it was a great meeting of exploring, you know, what our district does. And we have our second meeting this Saturday, and we look forward to that. We are been working on trying to get a joint meeting with FIRE, and so we have worked out some things on that, and we'll be talking about more of those particular details further on in the meeting. And on the long-term care nursing front, it's summertime and COVID is, you know, they haven't met yet. We're waiting on the announcement if we got the second grant that we applied for, the care coordination grant, which is the $249,000 or $50,000 grant for 3 years. So we're really anxiously awaiting for that. We should be hearing any time because it starts September 1st. And to that note, I was contacted by Gary Waters of Peace Island Medical Center offering our district the use of an intern that he has come to him needing an internship for 1 year and then another for another year to help on social work. They're getting their master's in social work or any other administrative function. We could have her or him for a minimum of 10 hours a week or more. And like I say, we can probably have an intern for the next 2 years if we like. And seeing that we are a small island, it would be great if we did take advantage of that. It's no cost to us. We'd be helping them with their education, and we would have extra hands to work on anything, you know, that comes up on what we're doing. And the first intern is Libby Howard, which a lot of people may know. The last name Howard, that is Vern Howard's daughter. So, and I've met and talked with her, and she already has an undergraduate degree, a master's in business degree, and now she's getting her master's in social work. So she would be a great addition to be able to have and us utilize and help our bandwidth of services without having to actually affect our budget. So I would like if they're to vote on that for you, commissioners, that would be agreeable if I did sponsor and we sponsored her internship.
Well, Pam, do we vote on that? It would be your responsibility, and she would be there.
Yes, my responsibility, but if y'all had any major, you know, we don't really want to be doing that, you know, if there's any objections. I just want to make sure that you all don't have any, you know, strong objections.
I
think it's a fantastic idea.
I agree.
Okay, yeah. Great. I should be getting the paperwork this next week, so we'll be setting up her hours, her schedule to work, and we have the room in our district offices for her to get set up there. So I think it will be a very beneficial relationship, and I'm really looking forward to working with her.
Awesome.
Good.
Is Kylan Everett with us as well?
Yes, as long as can utilize her help and work with her, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I'll speak up if I disagree.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks, Kyle. Okay. We'll do that.
Thank you, Pam. I'm happy to welcome Libby. I think she's a great person and will be a wonderful addition to your team.
Great. The other thing that I just learned in the last day after I wrote my report is that Rock Island Communications is finally putting a fiber optic line in our complex at Spring Street where we are. And they now it requires no out-of-pocket costs for the organizations there. They will put that in for free. And then we would have access to it. It would cost $95 a month plus $20 for some administration fee. So it would be about $115 a month. But if we discontinued our Century Link, the cost increase would only be, $20 to $25 a month. And we would get a fiber optic line that we would have steady internet, we can get faster downloads and much faster uploads. And since we will have to be doing these virtual meetings for quite some time, and we were looking at getting more technical things for our office, this will greatly improve our options there. So I'm really excited about that. So just wanted to let y'all know on that front that I was going to sign up that, yes, we were interested in doing that. So, let's see. That is about it for me. If anybody has any questions, I would love to answer them.
This is Commissioner Loring. I do have one question. Before I do, I should thank Chair Lindstrom for opening it up last time so that people can speak, my snide comment aside. I do appreciate you making sure every one of us gets an opportunity, so thanks. I know it's a challenge in this format. But my question for you, Superintendent Hutchins, was that I noticed there was a statement about COVID cases from visitors in your report, and I hadn't, my understanding was that the cases we've had have really been from islanders visiting off island with families or family members coming to the island, bringing them from what I've seen. I may be incorrect on that, but if that is right, I just want to make sure we're doing our best not to villainize visitors. And I'm not taking a statement on whether people should be coming here or not at the moment, but I see that sometimes, and I just want to make sure it's warranted. If so,
right.
I
don't want to villainize the visitors either. I got the facts from the EOC that the cases that we have had was brought by someone coming from the mainland, or one of us, or something going off to the mainland or another state and coming back and bringing most of that is how it the original cases get started. And then there were those ones that, of course, spread in the family after that person got back. So that's, I think we're up to 25 now total cases. So thanks, Kyle.
But he is correct that they do come from, they don't come from tourists, and a lot of people are villainizing tourism, but they have come from people visiting family off-island and coming back, et cetera. And not as many people who are tourists, because the tourists go home and then they test positive at home, and then they contact trace here, but they wouldn't report them in our county anyway because they're not from here. So our cases are all local because they're coming from going off island, or having people coming to visit in their home.
Okay. Thank
you. It's reassuring that the tourists are not spreading COVID to the rest of us. And I feel great about that. Well, thank you so much, Superintendent Hutchins, and we'll move on to the EMS operations report from Interim Chief Cookson.
Thank you. Well, good evening, everyone. Just to kind of let you know, I'll start off with our department statistics. 85 runs for the month of June, which brings us to 486 for the current reporting for the year to date. We're experiencing about a 16% decrease in call volume. And, we've kind of talked about that previously and some of the reasoning behind that. Our average number of responders is about 2.7 for the month of June, The shoot times that we're seeing are staying consistent, just about 2.5 minutes. We're working on bringing those down. In terms of our response times overall, we're 93% of our calls are under our benchmark for a suburban area. We're at eight minutes and 41 seconds with 93% of the calls there and 69% of the calls under 10. So always trying to get faster and better. So we'll keep working toward that goal. Just some of the highlights, 74% of our calls are in town, 13% in the Mid-Island area, with about 5 to 6% of the calls going either north or south, and just a handful over on outer islands. As far as finances go, as Pam mentioned, we're 50% into the year. Our revenue for this month was $109,658, which brings our cumulative total to $1,000,003, and which means we're a little bit ahead of what our projections were, about 52% of what we projected. Our expenses were at $466,157, and that brings our cumulative to $1.4 million, which is just about right on target. And of course, that big increase this year in our expenditures was because we moved $300,000 into the reserve fund. So you'll see that in, even though it looks like a big jump in our expenditures, it's not so much we just kind of moved from our checking account to our savings account, more or less. The GEMT only collected about $32,000 this year, or this month, and our cumulative is $87,000, which is only about 28% of what we expected. Not exactly sure the reasoning that, other than the fact that we're running fewer calls, and of course these are more dependent on Medicare, Medicaid kinds of patients that we're seeing. So obviously a much less volume with those people relying on those services for payment. Our cash and reserves in the general fund are at $1.7 million, which is about 7 months of operating expenses. And of course now we have a new fund to report on, which is our reserve fund, and that's at $300,000, which is, we put about half of what we expected to into that fund, and we'll just kind of see as we go through our budget revision process if we can meet that target. I'm pretty confident that we can. I think things are looking pretty good this year, and we'll be able to reallocate as we need be, and we'll be able to build that reserve fund back up to where it should be. Does anybody have any questions about the finances or the statistics at this time?
Oh, this is Commissioner Loy. I've got a quick one. How'd we do on that truck?
We're collecting bids right now. What we did is we posted it online. We posted with the one of the news services. We also did on our Facebook page and our website. And we received a couple of bids. So we're going right now. We'll close the bidding at the end of the month, and we'll see how that all turns out. But we basically asked for a minimum. We used the Kelley Blue Book to determine the value of that, and then said we kind of discounted that by 10-20% because the truck does need new tires. And we set that as the minimum, and so we'll wait and see what we get for the bids there. But okay. It looks like we'll be able to get it all out of the lot. Yeah, at the end of the month, so that's great.
Thanks.
You bet. Any other questions? All right, I'll jump into the operations and just kind of hit the highlights. I think you all got the report. Hopefully you had a chance to take a look at it. Just as far as what's going on with the community, no big change, kind of status quo because of our COVID response. In terms of the union negotiations, I reached out to Rich Davis, our attorney, and asked him to get a hold of the union representation because we haven't heard anything from them yet. I also asked Rich as he went to reach out to their representative that he asked about whether or not we can start working on fixing the the situation we have with our staff EMTs. We have a scheduling issue that we need to take care of, overtime payment issues that need to be rectified because we want to be in compliance with the Fair Labor Standards Act and make sure that we're doing the right thing and moving forward. So we're hoping that they'll understand our situation and allow us to go ahead and start cleaning up that situation and rectifying it as we deal with negotiating a contract with the EMTs. Another issue came up about whether or not we were dealing with retirement systems correctly. Our collective bargaining agreement with the medics was performed under the PERS, the Public Employees Retirement System. That's what our medics were contributing to for their retirement. But we since moved to the Law Enforcement and Firefighters Fund, which is also called LEF. And they have very different reporting and requirements in terms of how you put that together. And the concern was brought up, are we doing this correctly? Because the contract was negotiated under one set of rules, and now we're dealing with the other. So I asked our attorney, Richard Davis, to look into that as well, and he's looked into it, taken a look at it, and he assures me that we're in compliance and that we're doing the right thing. So that was another thing that we checked off, and we're moving ahead and continuing with what we had been doing.
What was the reasoning to move from one retirement fund to the other?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
What was the reasoning to move the paramedics retirement funding to the LEFT program over the other?
It's a more robust program. Most folks enjoy it more. It pays out better at the end of your employment term, and it takes into account the kind of the stress factors of being a first responder. You're able to retire sooner with better benefits. And so it was, deemed that, that's a good choice for us.
Okay.
Yeah. In terms of operations, we're still working under our COVID-19 response model, trying to stay ahead of it and keep the community healthy, keep our responders healthy, and give us some depth. We're also continuing to limit the access to the EMS station from the public, working with small groups here of our responders. A couple of our responders have let us know that they won't be responding any longer. One of which is Nick Wainwright. He's a full-time dispatcher, kind of started a new business, and he is still responding as a firefighter. Just realized that he's stretched too thin to continue with EMS. Our other volunteer responder that we has decided to retire is Francis Smith, who's been a longtime responder. As long as I can remember, Francis was here every Tuesday, just camped out, ready to go, and put a lot of years in, a lot of service to the community. And I think COVID was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back, more or less, and said, all right, it's time to really retire and enjoy himself. And both of those guys will be sorely missed. But we wish them well, and we'll continue on for John. And I know they'll stay involved with what's going on with emergency responses, so that's good to know.
Well, please pass along our appreciation for their service.
I will definitely do that. Thank you. The North Region Trauma Council continues to meet remotely. There was no meeting in June. There wasn't one, an early meeting in July. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me back up. There was one special meeting in June, and that was to get approval for the Paycheck Protection Program. A lot of the fundraising that the North Region does couldn't be done, and so they applied for the federal program to make sure that they were able to pay their staff, and that was approved. There was a meeting in early July that was more or less kind of an update on status and situation, and we'll report on that for the next period since it did happen in July. Nothing earth-shattering that you need to know. Same holds true with our county EMS. We met in June, but there was no quorum present. We just kind of gave some quick updates to see what was going on. Dr. Corse has been involved with that and helping out there. Good news on the CODAN radio project. Just found out just this week that the county council approved resolutions to secure the bond to pay for the project and to give an authorization for the county to enter into contracts, both with Rock Island and Codan. So those contracts, I'm assuming, are going to be executed very, very soon, and they'll get started on putting this radio project together for us. So exciting news for us. I was talking to the staff this morning and kind of said, chances are, because our radio system on San Juan Island is pretty good compared to the others, we'll probably be the last ones to see the updates. I'm sure they'll head off for Shaw and Lopez and the backside of Orcas first, because those are the real, real problem areas. And we'll probably see the last part of the project will come here to San Juan. But it's good to know that we'll have much, much better radio communications. And we also had our first radio users group meeting that was convened for, it's been a long time since that happened, and I do want to just give recognition to our lead dispatcher, Robin De La Zarda, who is also an EMT who responds with his agency. She's kind of coordinating that, and she's been doing an excellent job. Peace Island Medical Center has also kind of spooled up their multidisciplinary trauma quality team and asked me to participate with that, and I'm happy to do that. We had our first meeting. That's Teresa Loya, who kind of headed that. As explained, she's the nurse manager who is now also taking over the administrative part of the clinical of the nurses in lieu of Marianne Keene's departure. So I'll be meeting with those regularly. I think we meet every other month. And the idea is we're going to try to rebuild some of those bridges between the ED and EMS, and to work some joint trainings and work on that handoff, making sure that we take the patient from the field and get a good, smooth handoff to the ED and working together for upcoming situations as they arise. And then Commissioner Loring already asked about the pickup truck, so we're good to go with that. That was one of the things that I wanted to point out. Staff trainings are going well. Again, when we do our run reviews and our QI, QA, we're doing that remotely with Dr. Corso. That way the whole group can remote in. There's a little bit of education involved with that. And then hands-on training, we've gone to small groups. And with the four teams now, we are able to spread out and manage and keep the groups small. We opened up during the month of June to these smaller groups, and everybody came in to get their skills testing complete and finished, and everybody's up to speed, which is very, very exciting. Everybody worked really hard. A lot of our folks who are evaluators put in a lot of extra time to make sure that the other responders had somebody there to run through and do the evaluations of their skill set, and got them all checked off, and we're up to speed. We're good. Everybody's good to go, and now we can start working through scenario-based trainings. So that second Tuesday of every month will be more hands-on scenario-based, and the fourth Tuesday of every month will be the remote with Dr. Corsa, and then some education on top of that, at least through the time that we have to limit the size of the group through the COVID situation that we're dealing with. Just a quick update about community paramedicine. We're still working. We have not had a chance to meet regionally yet, that I think I reported on last month. But we're working within our internal team here. And of course, as we talked about in our special meeting on Saturday, the term mobile integrated health is being used pretty interchangeably with community paramedicine. But then I found out that actually we're using community paramedicine correctly. Mobile integrated health tends to be more of a broader brush that deals with the community services outside of the hospital and the pre-hospital setting. So you may hear me use them interchangeably. I hope that doesn't cause too much confusion. I attached on this last update to you a little sheet that explained the difference, the subtle differences between what people are calling mobile integrated health and what people are calling community paramedicine. So we'll just keep plugging away. Again, our goal is to try to get rules and policies and procedures in place that can be used both regionally and locally, regionally, and at the state level, and then to try to make sure that we can secure funding to keep this project going once the grant funding disappears for us. As far as COVID goes, I think Pam did a nice job of summarizing that, that they're finding evidence that says there may be an aerosolized component to the infection, as well as the droplet spread that had been talked about earlier. And I think that Dr. James was explaining in the last briefing that the evidence seems to be, like Pam was explaining, it's happening in households where, as travel restrictions were lifted, friends and family come over, they visit, you're in the house, the air circulation isn't as great as when you're outdoors and your contact is closer. And so you're seeing that spread within the household. So again, working on that. The other interesting thing is that the demographic for the rise in cases is that age 20 to 29 is where we're seeing most of that uptick in cases. Again, these folks are much more mobile. They have a bigger, a broader base of friends and acquaintances that they're dealing with. And they're seeing that bigger uptick. And of course, that contradicts what was talked about earlier, where it was, hey, you know, kids, when they get it, they very rarely show symptoms. They bounce back fast. I call them kids. I apologize. I guess I'm feeling my age right now. They're not kids. They're young adults. That they bounce back quickly, that the symptoms aren't as severe, not so much the case. So I think it's kind of a relearning thing for that demographic there. And the other interesting thing was that, of course, our phase three application was withdrawn by the county council, returned by the governor's office. No date has been set as to when the governor's office will start accepting applications to move into more or less restrictive phases. The governor's reserved the right to be able to make more restrictions on any county, depending on what those levels look like. And right now it's eastern Washington along the Columbia and Okanagan valleys that tend to have the highest rates. I think those seven counties that all kind of border the Columbia are the ones that are showing the highest rates of infection. So that's what we know about COVID. What else do I have for you? One other thing that I failed to mention is every summer, Peace Island Medical Center brings in resident doctors as part of their training in rural emergency medicine. Those residents have been showing up. I think this is doctor number three Dr. Gleek is here right now. They usually come along and they sign our ride-along forms and we try to get them out on the ambulance with us. And they have been participating. We've had several of the doctors be able to get to the back of the rig and jump in and go out on our calls with us. So that's always exciting. It's good to see those. Dr. Haysloop, who used to be our supervising physician, was one of those physicians that was here as a resident. Dr. Moyers, who is here periodically at Peace Island Medical Center, was also one of those residents who ended up being here and participating and being part of our community. So it's always exciting to see those folks come in, and we welcome them as well. So that's what I have for you. If you have any questions, please, happy to answer them right now. All right, thank you.
Quiet. Okay, thank you, Carl. Moving on to unfinished business, we have committee reports and discussion. I'm not clear on if some of these met or not. The first one would be off-island transport.
Sorry, I had to unmute myself. No, that off-island transport committee has not met. And I think we'll probably be looking at a challenge because it was Marianne Keene who was kind of coordinating that. So we'll have to find out how to put that back together and get that back on track. I know we stopped meeting during the COVID, but we'll see if we can kind of figure out a way to do it more remotely.
Okay, and I believe there was a community collaboration committee meeting.
Trish attended that. I didn't. I thought it was canceled, but
Yeah, I got an email saying it was canceled too, so I thought it was as well. But Trish, you did participate.
I did participate, yes. And it was very interesting. There was a lot of discussion about community outreach to the Latinx community for COVID education, vaccinations, and accessibility for COVID information and education. There was a discussion about just general immunizations and efforts to improve adult and children's vaccinations in the setting of COVID, because of course people don't want to go in for appointments. So Janice Fisher, who is, I think she's the director of the Peace Island Medical Center Clinic, she spoke to the current statistics for ages 0 to 2 years, and we weren't meeting the sort of goals set for that. There was a bit of discussion about that. And then also, there was discussion about the flu vaccine coming up that will be ramping up for, you know, in what, 6 weeks is September. 6 weeks is September, everybody. So I, you know, I'm just wondering about maybe the hospital district providing some extra funds, maybe for to talk with the clinic and talk with public health about maybe community paramedicine helping with flu vaccinations this fall for elders who are homebound. So just something to think about.
Is that something Heather Vogel would be available to do? I'm just asking, like, you know, within EMS and maybe under the umbrella of mobile integrated health or just.
Yeah, that was something that Pam and I discussed earlier this afternoon, how we may be able to assist that. Obviously, community paramedicine seems to be a good umbrella that might work. Heather is definitely qualified to a registered nurse. The other possibility would be, you know, if we can get the authorization for one of our paramedics to help out with that, would be another possibility. But I'm sure we can, you know, we'll be happy to offer our services and see what we can do to kind of, you know, help that situation.
Yeah, I think the only, you know, big detail to work out is the billing for, you know, payment for the flu vaccines. Yeah.
Right. Again, it's just always logistics, but we'll get it figured out. We'll do what we need to do.
It would be great to do some research on that and see if we can work with the Department of Health and PIs to make that happen. A lot of people aren't going to be comfortable going to the clinic to get their vaccinations this year and keep up.
Right. But for seniors, it's covered through Medicare, so it's just a matter of figuring out that billing. And certainly, public health knows how to do that, so that shouldn't be facing up.
Great. Thank you, Trish. Was that it for the Community Collaboration Committee?
That was it.
Yeah. Thank you. And was there a Trauma Care Council meeting this month as well?
There was. That's what Carl reported on that.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Not a lot of going on.
And nothing on the CID, I see.
That's correct. Still no word on that. And the last correspondence I had with our attorney on that front was, let's just kind of let COVID settle before we reach out to the Attorney General's office again and see where they're going. And it's always that kind of double-edged sword that no news is good news, and the clock keeps ticking away. There is a statute of limitations on this. If they don't figure out something within a certain time frame, it becomes a non-issue.
What is the time frame for that?
I believe we're not sure if it's 7 years or 10 years.
What are we at in this count? I mean, are we
four and a half? I'd have to take a look, something like that. It's been a long time since this was initiated.
I was really hoping we could get this resolved so it wasn't a liability that was hanging over our heads as we discuss integration, but Okay.
It'd be nice to have a definitive answer. You know, you don't want to just pay what they're suggesting just to kind of get it off your plate if there was no reason, no grounds behind it. So having something that everybody can say, yeah, let me see what you're talking about, and we can either rebut or, you know, and deal with these specific issues. There were no specifics given in that first correspondence we got from the Attorney General asking for a payment. So, again, still hasn't responded with any specifics.
Okay, thank you. The next report would be the Finance Committee, which is Everett and myself. But, you know, we had some robust discussion on Saturday about finances and being fiscally responsible. And I thought this might be a good time to sort of review the way our levy works and talk about what happened in 2008 when property values did go down, and how, as the value built back up, how that revenue was then retrieved. And generally, I think of Nathan as our expert on these things, but I don't want to single him out. But I suppose any one of the three staff members can explain this much more concisely than I can. So I'll open that up to you.
Chief, Pam, do you guys want me to do that, or which one of you want to take it?
Mute myself because my cat is really loud and meowing. Go ahead, Nathan, and I'll chime in if I want to add something.
Okay. Chief, that okay with you?
Absolutely.
Okay. So just kind of in brief, I know property taxes are complicated. What happened that Cheryl Lindstrom is alluding to is a decade or so ago during the financial crash, property values went down. I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this. Basically what happens is all levies have a maximum rate that you can tax. And there are technical terms for these things, but the maximum rate that you can tax for a EMS district currently is 50 cents. And so if you are currently taxing at that maximum rate based on current housing assessed values, if property values drop, that means you're collecting too much tax. You start going above that 50 cent rate. And then what that means is you actually start losing money. That's a bit of a theoretical risk for us. We're currently at, I think, 42 cents for EMS and 40 for the hospital district. The hospital district's maximum levy rate is 75 cents. So we're really nowhere near the maximum on that. But as I said, the maximum rate for EMS is 50 cents. Usually our rate drops every year, and that's because assessed values are going up. And so since you can only take an extra 1% per year, you're kind of collecting less and less of the assessed value, and so your rate goes down. I know that's probably as clear as mud. This is really hard to explain, like, just verbally, but I can send you guys great. The best thing to do is look at charts. Charts that will show you, here's assessed values, here's how they're changing. Here's what happens if they go up, here's what happens if they go down. And then that rate is adjusted accordingly. So yeah, I mean, and back in 2010, or what year was that? Was it 2009? You know, back then the maximum EMS rate was 35 cents. And this is one of the reasons it was changed. And so we bumped up against that 35 cent limit. And so every year we were getting less money. A few weeks ago, I sent you guys kind of, an overly complicated explanation about this, as I tend to do. I can dig that out somewhere. but they kind of talked about that history and how that impacted our budgets and impacted revenues every year. It's right now currently a theoretical risk. Housing values would have to drop a whole lot for us to be in trouble. When we reach the 6 years of our levy, is it 6 or 8 years, Chief? It's six, right?
It's six,
yeah. When we reach the end of our six-year levy, we'll renew that levy. And typically what you do is you would go back out for kind of what you did last time. And we had a 50-cent levy last time. So I suppose the one situation where this could matter is if, say, we went out for a renewal of our levy and we went out for the full 50 cents, and then the next year property values dropped. In that situation, you would lose some money. Anyway, Annalisa, does that answer the question? Do you have more specific questions you want?
No, when I'm sure Chief Kutzing or Pam could add to it. I just think it's important to note that if property values do go down, it takes us a while to come back from that and then to recover that revenue as property values then go back up again. So
yeah, that's kind of the bottom line, just to simplify it. Plenty of other states say, here's your levy rate. If property values go up, your levy, the amount you collect goes up. If property values go down, the amount you collect goes down. With Washington, it's different. You set your rate. If property values go up, you don't necessarily match the value that it goes up. You only go up 1%. And then if it goes up, you go up 1%. You go up. Consequently, it takes a long time to build back up, and that renewal kind of resets the scale. Going down is completely different. If property values plummet, your collection rate plummets along with it, and then as property slowly recovers, you recover much more slowly because you're limited to that 1%. That's how it works in Washington. So it gets complicated. Other states, it's a little easier. Just if it goes up, then your collection goes up. If it goes down, your collection goes down. And you plan based on that. But Washington's a little wonky.
The thing about it is, what it's designed to do is to preserve your revenue as consistent as possible. It's basically a system that chooses complexity and consistency over, say, transparency. Because no one understands property taxes unless, you know, someone pays you to figure it out and actually do it, like Pam and I and Carl. But the point is that mostly, like, your revenue is pretty consistent. And that is one nice thing about the system, that even if property taxes do go down, provided you're below your maximum rate, your revenue will stay the same. And you look at, say, the town, which is dealing with, like, a sales tax, you know, when the economy goes down, you know, their revenue just collapses. And they may be at a time where their residents most need them to be able to provide government services. And fortunately, we can avoid that, particularly right now, like during COVID. We're in no risk of not being able to pay our subsidy to Peace Health, for instance, because our budget is stable. It's as clear as mud, but it's pretty stable. You know, that's kind of the trade-off.
Also, with our two property tax levies, the hospital district is on a permanent levy. So that's why, you know, we have a maximum of 75 cents, and we can only increase our property taxes 1%. But if property taxes go down, so every year they go down, that's why, you know, we're down to 40 cents because we're on a permanent levy. It just keeps, you know, pace with that. But EMS is on a six-year levy cycle, so they have the opportunity to reset. You know, they may be down to 42 or get down to 38 at the end of that six-year levy, but then when it's voted back in, and they can reset it back up to 50 cents, so they make up, you know, a little bit faster than on being on a property levy, because they get to reset at what the property values are there. They don't have to wait. for 1% every year.
Thank you, everyone. That is really helpful, clarifying. Anybody else have any comments on that?
I can't tell if you're being sarcastic or not.
No, I'm not being sarcastic. I'm serious. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, if anybody has questions, though, reach out and ask. We're happy to help. I know it's confusing.
Yeah. Okay. Inter Island Healthcare Foundation, is there anything there? And long-term care?
No, we're waiting, I say, on that announcement for that care coordination grant. But in the background, Inter Island Healthcare Foundation is still doing their work on the feasibility study, looking at the accountant is doing the pro forma cost analysis thing. So when we do whether or not we get the grant or not, you know, that will be coming out, and we'll be having a meeting to look at those results and see if, you know, what we can do in the future.
Okay.
I've never gotten any notification about any meetings. I know Gail and I are on that committee. Have there been any meetings?
There hasn't been any meetings for the hospital district people from the summer. And I'd say the foundation is still gathering that financial information. So, but there should be one, and the meeting should be more frequent as the fall gets here. So.
Okay. Thank you. Community relations, Trish, there isn't much to report, really. We as a board wrote to the staff at EMS, you know, just reiterating our support of them and our appreciation of their hard work during this time. There wasn't much that came to us from the public in the last month, so I don't have much to report there. Yeah. Okay, so we'll move on to integration of EMS and fire. And today, I've been emailing back and forth with Commissioner Jarman, and you know, we had proposed having an independent moderator for our meeting, and initially the fire department discussed it and rejected that idea. Bob let me know. I wrote back to him saying that we really thought it would be the most efficient way to run the meeting. And after they reached out to Duncan Wilson, who is the person that we had suggested to be our moderator, they have agreed that we can move forward with a joint meeting with Duncan as our moderator. So I asked Nathan to forward you the agenda, the proposed agenda that I had received back from Commissioner Jarman. It still seems that according to Robert's Rules of Order, the fire and rescue would like a joint chair. I don't know how important that is, but we can certainly do that. But anyway, I don't know. I know this came late in the day today, and so I'm not sure if any of you have had a chance to look at the agenda for the special meeting and what its current format is. But I don't know if we want to discuss that or if we want to do that through Nathan next week. I think that we do need to talk about some of the finer points on this, as listed on our agenda, specifically go, no go topics. But I think that could be handled, you know, via email through the week if that's the case, if everyone is happy with the idea of a joint meeting and having Duncan Wilson chair it and no one has great objections to the agenda that's in front of us at this time.
I can put it up on the screen if you'd like.
sure. Yes. I'm waiting for Kyle to say something.
And I was waiting to say something. That worked out so well.
Beautiful.
Thank you, Chair Lindstrom. I think that the agenda, I think I'm pretty comfortable with the agenda. I don't understand having a moderator and a chair of the meeting. I was actually hoping that we would have somebody essentially chair it, call it a moderator, call it whatever you want, who was not one of the two entities that were coming together on this. And that's still my position. We need somebody. I think it'd be helpful to have somebody outside of those entities. They should just help guide us through the course. And I think we have an agenda that looks like it touches on the topics we all want to discuss, from what I can tell. I don't understand the reticence on the fire district board's part in having a neutral third party basically help sit us down and have a conversation.
Yeah, I think they've come around to really having a moderator. I think that the idea of election of a joint chair was their concern that we were following Robert's rules of order. I don't really understand it. I don't know. I don't think Robert's rules of order actually requires that. We could all just vote to agree that Mr. Wilson is our moderator / chair for the meeting.
That would be my position, but I'm sorry, I interrupted. I'll just finish up. That would be my position, but I got the impression from what we've heard that the fire district board would not be comfortable with that. Otherwise, they would just say that he will be our moderator / chair.
I believe that it has to do with the rules behind an elected board, that a non-commissioner, a non-elected person can't chair the meeting. And I think that's where that might come from. I'd have to double check on the rules for governance that way. I think that's where the objection comes from. And so you can have
We just had our strategic planning meeting, and it was moderated by Daphne Snyder.
That's
we
true.
Didn't run that meeting.
Yeah.
Well, so, I guess we did. There was a chairman, I guess.
Right, because Chair Lindstrom actually convened the meeting, called it to order, and then we kind of deferred to Daphne to go ahead and kind of lead the discussion. And I think that's the same kind of thing we need. We need to have someone who's elected to be able to chair. But again, I'd have to look more into it to understand, but I believe that's where the reservation was.
Nathan?
Yeah, I thought I would try the raise your hand function. Just showing off over here. Yeah, I'm not sure the exact concern that Chair Jarman is raising. We will have a chair, though. I mean, Annalisa is still the chair, and they would have their own chair. I've seen, like, you know, the Port of Friday Harbor have a joint meeting with the Town of Friday Harbor. You know, there's two chairs in the room, and they're each kind of holding separate meetings that happen to be in the same space. There's certainly nothing in the OPMA that prohibits it. I mean, it sounded like to me he was raising an objection based on Robert's rules of order that if you're going to have a joint meeting that you need to have a joint chair. And I don't know whether that's true or not. It certainly could be. You're not really bound to follow Robert's rules of order, and I guess it just depends on whether the board wants to acquiesce to this or not.
Well, we could just not make it an issue, and then, I mean, if both chairs just open and close the meeting and state their, you know, the beginning of their meeting and the end of their meeting, and then Duncan moderates, that seems like it's fine. And that's what sounds like from that email, that he is amenable to Duncan moderating it, so that nobody runs on and goes on and on and whatever. So if we can clarify.
It sounds like it's a formality, really.
Yeah, maybe it's a formality. So maybe we shouldn't give it much energy.
Yeah,
and just I'm really appreciative we've reached an agreement and that we can work to set a date. What I propose is if you have go no go topics, you know, in the next, you know, I know we have a lot of work to do right now and there's a lot going on, but Maybe just push them to Nathan so he can compile a list and then we can work from there. Does that sound reasonable to everyone?
Yes.
Okay. Can you clarify what a go, no-go topic is? Is it what we can't talk about at the meeting, or is it what our requirements are for integration to happen, what we consider essential? Which one is it? I was confused about that.
I think if you have a specific, we could say the absolutes of the CAG are our terms for this, you know, things like that. I mean, we actually haven't quite hashed those out. So,
which people are we have to have, and which we could be compromised on.
I want to be sure that this is a net zero cost to the community, that integrating these two agencies isn't going to cost more money than operating them separately. Something like that, I think, would be an absolute condition that we would have specifically that would mean whether or not we can move this process forward. Does that make sense to everyone?
I believe it does.
Okay.
It's not a no-go topic for the meeting. Things we will not talk about at the meeting. It's about what our conditions are for integration.
I think so.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
I think the idea was that we don't really, the intention of this meeting isn't to try to negotiate or work out any of the detailed issues relating to integration, but that if each board wanted the chance to read kind of a list of preconditions or go, no-goes that will need to be discussed and negotiated as time goes on, that we would be able to do that. But we weren't going to try to discuss them per se. I think that was my understanding, Annalisa. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think so. And we could certainly clarify with Commissioner Jarman as well. So it's just something for everyone to think about. Should we move on to strategic planning?
Sure.
Sorry. Do we want to talk about proposing a date or dates?
Yeah, again, I feel like I would just dump that on Nathan. Everyone.
Okay.
I think the sooner the better, personally.
I concur.
Okay.
Yeah, we did. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, one of the things Annalisa asked was that we proceed with having the board recording secretary schedule a joint meeting. We didn't hear back on that point that I recall, but we can follow up with them, and then I can check with you guys regarding your availability.
Your favorite, scheduling. Okay, thank you for that. So discussion of ongoing strategic planning. I really enjoyed our time on Saturday. It seems like we are fine-tuning, and I think it's a great practice. There were some discussion of service to underserved populations, and I was hoping maybe Gail or Trish could sort of expand on that.
Yeah, I sort of made a list of underserved populations. Underserved populations. So, for instance, uninsured people are underserved because they don't have medical insurance, so they can't afford it. They might show up in the ER, but they don't go for preventive care because they don't have insurance.
Yeah.
Medicaid clients are underserved populations for a huge amount of reasons. Some of them just accessing care is uncomfortable, and they're not, they're not used to accessing care. They may, you can't see a dentist here. That's a Medicaid dentist. If you're children, adults, anybody, there are no Medicaid dentists here. So you have to go off island for Medicaid. That's why we have that dental van coming in. So I'll say that this underserved population, this is where there's lots of think tanks working on serving these populations. all the time. So we have lots of conversations going on about it, but these are really important issues that our community faces. Medicare doesn't cover dental or vision. So old people, teeth rotting in their mouths, who need dentures, cannot pay for them. They need $10,000 of their own money to try to get dentures. So that's a huge underserved issue that's across the, you know, across the country, it's not just here. Latino population tends to be underserved, sort of language issues, because of feeling safety and comfort where they're going to the doctor at, to feel like they're safe to go to the doctor. So we have that going on here. Seniors who need in-home care, there are not enough caregivers here for people who need in-home care. Out-of-home placement in a facility, as we know, the Life Care Center's gone. So anybody that needs out-of-home placement, temporary or permanent, it could just be rehab for somebody, inpatient rehab, isn't available on the island, so they have to do that off-island. And lower and middle-income people don't have enough money to pay for, like, the Village of the Harbor, which is a facility, but it's very expensive. Blind people here might not have access to care as much. There's not as many places to get sight aid as there are in the mainland, and I know the library has picked up the slack on that and provides a lot of care, a lot of information on different ways to vision, for vision care for busy people who are blind. There's no adult daycare on the island, so for caregivers who need respite on the mainland, there's a lot of facilities who will do adult programs for 3 or 4 hours, and you can bring your client in, your family member in for a while you go to the store or something. We don't have any adult daycare, so there's no respite for caregivers on the island. There's no 24-hour hospice care. So for patients who need hospice care in the middle of the night on the mainland, hospice can come to your house, but here they can't. So you have to, as a caregiver, a family member, you have to somehow figure out how to take care of your family member when hospice can't be there. So it's a less service as on the mainland. Medical transportation is a huge population. Understood. Mental health transportation, we've had this issue just recently. Was that something that came up at the, what meeting did that come up in? That was actually, I can't remember where it came up, but the people were in mental health crisis who need to get off island to a facility. The providers of ambulance services said, we're no longer going to provide for you guys. We're not going to come over and get people, even though they're paid about $125 a client through Medicaid, and they were being subsidized $250 from Peace Health to come get a client. And they said that doesn't work for us, bottom line. So she was going to look into, Beth Williams Giger is going to look into that if that was true, but that's one of the things we run into is definitely Medicaid transportation won't come to the island to get you. If you can get on the ferry and get off the ferry, they might pick you up at the ferry dock, but for certainly the mental health crisis, that's not going to happen because you need to be monitored the whole time. Folks in wheelchairs and walkers are underserved because they can't get to meetings. We don't have any public transportation that accounts for people in wheelchairs and walkers. We do have some local hacks that we've made. You know, we have the Round Towner and that will work with Peace Island, and Peace Island takes the Round Towner to pick people up. So there are things that have happened, but that's one of the fixes to gaps and services that we've come up with as a community. We also have the transportation voucher program where people get a voucher to ride taxis as opposed to what they would have public transportation passes on the mainland provided to them. So the county gets a certain fund that they can give out to people so that they take a cab around town and then to go to the store for themselves or to get to appointments as well. So cancer care is another people who need cancer care have a harder time getting served as well. People with chronic mental illness and mental health issues are just a general underserved population because they don't reach out. They need someone to reach out to them. They need lots of follow-up, and they need case managers. So mental health services, people with drug abuse and alcohol issues also don't access treatment frequently because they're afraid of being ostracized or not being safe to receive services as well. Though there's been some great programs that Peace Island has put together for opiate abuse and what different issues. So they have been bridging that gap. People with chronic pain, there's no chronic pain specialist on the island. There's no liver dialysis on the island. So there's things that aren't here for people, ways that we don't serve people, and then there's people that just don't come in because of different issues. So does that make sense? Kind of some of our...
This is a little minor detail. You said liver dialysis, but I know you meant kidney.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Whichever organ that is.
Yeah, one of those, yeah.
Thank you. Not being a medical provider, you can tell.
The daunting list.
And it's being worked on all the time. Like I said, there's lots of things Pink's working on, all those issues. That's why I know about them, because we've been trying to fill those gaps for a long time.
And Trish, you have experience in, like, your work, you know, I mean, why does everything happen after 5 o'clock on Friday? And what services are available to people then, and how much problem solving do you have to do as a caregiver?
It's very, very challenging. I've had a call here at home, not even, you know, as a home health person from Peace Island Medical Center with a patient at... it was complicated, but this was a patient who lives alone, was in a medical crisis, needed to go have some treatment on the mainland, but she wanted to come home, but she lives alone. And anyway, it was quite a hullabaloo, and her friend called me, and then I talked to the new discharge planning person, and the nurse to talk about, you know, options for them. But, you know, it's tough. If you live alone and you have a health crisis on this island, you pretty much don't have many options. And if you have no money, you are probably going to have to be in a Medicaid-funded... the Medicaid facility, of which there are very few. And it's a tremendous hardship on these folks. But, you know, even in home health, I mean, as I was a case manager for Lopez, Orcas, and San Juan Island, and I had patients who had wound care needs, and if they were on the mainland, they could have had a nurse come every day. But there was, you know, we had to find people to train them if they had daily wound care, and often that was paid for out of pocket. And that's very challenging, and it's got to be somebody who's willing and able to be trained how to do this, because, you know, we didn't have nurses to be able to go to, you know, all the islands. It's, but on the mainland, if you lived on the mainland, you would probably be able to have, you know, daily wound care, if that was needed. So, but, I mean, I could go on. I think that really... Gail has done a fine job of mentioning a laundry list of challenges with our geographically challenged location.
Oh, yeah, there's that too, yeah. So that we talked about both those issues of strategic planning, underserved populations, and whether we wanted to highlight that we are going to be focused on underserved populations in our work. But I do think that it can be part of the vision statement as well if it's not part of the mission.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
Any questions about anything I listed or that Trish said?
Thank you for that. I feel like I have a more comprehensive understanding of what we're looking at. I guess, and then the parking lot items that we talked about, were there anything more to add to things for Saturday other than underserved populations? If not, we can move on to new business. Okay. So we're working on the revised budget process, and Pam, would you like to take this on? You have to unmute yourself first. Hold on.
Okay.
There you are.
And just before I start this, I just want to remind the commissioners that
Daphne wanted the homework by Wednesday night. Today's Wednesday, so a few of you already sent it in, and it was, I really have enjoyed looking at those. Good work. So just wanted that small reminder for that.
I will get mine in my front.
I'm naughty. I think I sent mine directly to Daphne and forgot to send you. I'm so sorry, Pam.
Okay. Nathan and me and Carl were kind of like, oh, we didn't have any homework to do. But we decided that our homework was making sure that you guys were supported.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway.
It was me.
So I told Pam I wanted a different assignment. No, you guys have been great.
Well, it's been good. As I stated in my report, you know, we're through June. We're into the July of y'all. If you started your commission in January, it's time. It's getting into budget season. And I wanted to go over what the RCWs and what our district says about doing budgets for our this year amended and next year, our 2021. You all received a notebook and a copy showing that you could access the legal manual. And it's in Chapter 5 that describes the budget process in that you can refer to. Every year we do an amended budget somewhere anywhere between April and August. It kind of depends on when the county gets the beginning cash letter sent out. Because in our budgets, we estimate what our beginning cash will be for our budget. But then the year ends, and then they compute what our actual cash was. So they send us a letter that states this is what your beginning cash actual was for your budget year. We just got those, and I reported that for the district, we had about $11,000 more. So you want to make an amended budget to capture that fact and to have an actual beginning cash for your this year would be 2020 budget, and also to look at any of your particular line items and any things you are over in expense or under, that you can take a look at your whole budget and get it in a complete state for what you're looking at. And then comes it's getting time for doing the budget for 2021, and there are several dates, important dates for this. We usually start working on them in August, but you have to have your budget, or I do. That's one of my responsibilities as superintendent, is to have a budget ready for the board by November 1st, and let's see, pretty sure that's right. Yeah, I have to have it by November 1st to you, and then you have to have public hearings on your budget after I present it, and I'll present it at a board meeting. Then you look at it, we review it, we can amend it, talk about it. And then you would have to have a budget hearing, and we usually set that at a different hospital district meeting and publicize it as we're having our budget public hearing. And you have to have that done. And you have to have that hearing by November 15th. And then after your budget hearing, then you look at it again and make sure it's what you want. You have to have the completed budget to the county by November 30th. So you really have to pay attention to those dates. They're in the RCWs, and those are the three main things you have to do. And you also have to, because we get property taxes, you have to also in the, one of the budget hearings or when you're approving your budget, you have to have a tax levy resolution that states what you're levying for your taxes. And you also have to have a tax levy certification that certifies what you think your taxes are going to be. And those have to be sent to the tax assessor. And the tax assessor has to have those particular papers to be able to fund your property taxes every month. So that's kind of a general overview of the procedure that you have to have. So that's why when we start working on our budget like we are now, both Carl and I, for 2021, you know, that we try to get it out and present it early in September and be fine-tuning it by October so that there's room to for the public to really look at it, the board to really study it, us to really be able to go back and look at it again and again and again before we certify the budget. So it's a big process. But it's one of the most important things that we do as a district is setting our budget, and we have to we're mandated to be thoughtful and looking at everything and resourceful and accountable and not spending money, you know, frivolously. All those are kind of mandated when you look in the legal manual of what the commissioners are supposed to do and what Carla and I are supposed to do as far as administrators of the budget. And then that budget is important when it's finished. It acts as a blue book, a guidebook for us for the whole year to look against what we're spending, what we're getting in, to see if we, you know, are matching what we prepared in the budget. It keeps you accountable to be looking at your particular line items. And so it's a big process. It's an important process, but it is not a daunting process. It can be done. You just have to be mindful and start it early, so that you can do each step very thoughtfully and have enough time for everyone to look at it. You don't want to just throw your budget together, have your board look at it, and then get it out to the public, you know, a week before it has to go in, and then they don't have time. So that's why the RCW try to give you a timeline that they mandate you have to have it, so that it keeps everybody kind of on a schedule. But you can for sure do it earlier in the year, you know, and start working on it. So does anybody have any questions about the budget process? Nope. Yeah, and like I say, you can go to the legal manual and look on Chapter 5, and it tells you a lot of that. And then we'll be talking about it at every meeting now, probably until November 30th.
Something to look forward to. Thank you. if there are no further comments, I would open the meeting back up to audience participation. I'm not sure how much audience we have.
Yeah, we only have one person still, depending on how you count.
Okay. So you would press star 6 to unmute yourself at this time. And if we're okay, I think we would go ahead and move on to the executive session portion of our meeting under RCW 42.30.110 to evaluate the qualifications of an applicant for public employment or to review the performance of a public.
Excuse me, Chair Lindstrom, did I see a note that Dan Paulson has requested a statement to be read?
That was a mistake. It was just a copy and paste from
the Gotcha. Okay.
That was me. I'm sorry. I managed to screw that up twice today.
Oh, I can't believe that you made a mistake. Shocking.
Again with the sarcasm. Gosh, guys.
Well, at least you could tell that she was being sarcastic.
I apologize for that.
Executive session now. I guess we need to decide how long we're going to go for, because we would have to reconvene to then end the meeting, correct?
Yes.
Correct, okay. Yeah. Yeah, you got to announce the amount of time.
And then I will, if you say like an hour, 45 minutes, then I'm going to send out the invitation. And then you should be getting it, and you can join on that meeting.
Okay. Got it. Is an hour good? And can we end early if we say an hour?
No, if you end early, you have to wait. So I'd say 45 minutes at least. And then we can go back.
Okay, 45 minutes it is. So we are going to hang up now. Thank you, Chief. And let's see, so if we're going to hang up now, and do we want to take like a 5-minute break?
Sure. Sure.
Okay, so we'll say 7:10-ish, okay? And then that would mean we would be reconvening to close the meeting at 7:55.
Can we just make it 8 and call it good?
Okay.
Yeah, whatever. I'm not attached to anything.
So, okay.
We'll just say 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock
right.
Is.
Okay.
So we're hanging up.
Surely.
Okay, bye. Well, we won't. We'll hear you. Okay.